Good afternoon, Tri-States. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. And we are reading today's Telegraph Herald, Friday, August the 28th. This is Ken in the reader's seat. And remember, we are supported in part by Dupaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. Now, our first piece from the top of the fold, Virus Tallies Differ. An analysis by the Telegraph Herald shows that 22% of new confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Dubuque County were not factored into the 14-day positivity rate on Thursday. The 14-day period that ended Wednesday night marked the first two-week stretch in which the newspaper checked the state's coronavirus figures consistently at midnight. It disproved claims by state officials that the TH's county-specific positivity rate calculations, which remain consistently higher than those released by the state, were being skewed by the times at which the newspaper checked the state's totals. At 12:01 a.m. August 13th, the state reported a total of 21,163 COVID-19 test results in Dubuque County and 1,722 positive cases. Through the end of the day Wednesday, there were 2,248 new tests and 213 new cases in the county, resulting in a positivity rate of 9.5%. However, an examination of the state's website shows that only 167 of these new cases were assigned to specific days in the 14-day period. Thus, 46 of the 213, or about 22% of new positive tests, were not factored into the state's calculations of the county's rate. These figures led to a lower state-reported positivity rate of 7.1%. Utilizing underlying state data, the TH also found higher positivity rates in surrounding Iowa counties using nearly identical time frames, as well as inconsistencies in major counties throughout the state in results from this week. From 5 p.m. August 12th through 5 p.m. Wednesday, the TH found a positivity rate of 19.8% in Clayton County, compared with the state's calculation of 11.8%. In Delaware County, the underlying data indicate a two-week positivity rate of 16.6%, compared to the state's 11.7%. In Jackson County, it is 9% compared to the state's 7.4%, and in Jones, 8.7% compared to 7.1%. City of Dubuque Public Health Specialist Mary Rose Corrigan noted that tracking such figures is of the utmost importance at a time when students are returning to classrooms. "We are at a critical point," she said. "We have multiple local colleges and universities in our community, and they are starting up at the same time at our local schools." Corrigan emphasized that the resumption of classes will have a ripple effect that extends beyond the students and employees at educational institutions. "It certainly impacts the broader population," she said. "That is how this pandemic occurs, spreading from one person to another." The recent calculations by the TH disprove one of many theories that the state officials put forth in an attempt to explain the discrepancies between state-reported positivity rates and the state's own underlying data. 2 weeks ago, Pat Garrett, a spokesman for Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, pointed to the newspaper's tracking its figures at 5 p.m. rather than the end of the day as a reason for the inconsistencies. Instead, the state's practice of not counting recent confirmed cases until all data is received, such as the date of birth of the testee, continues to drive down the positivity rate, even though those cases have been confirmed in a specific county. For example, on Wednesday, the number of new confirmed cases in Dubuque County increased by 18, but the state only had verified one of those cases as of the time that the 14-day positivity rate was calculated. Iowa Department of Public Health spokeswoman Amy McCoy defended the state's COVID-19 data in an email to the Telegraph Herald on Thursday. When you think about any data, whether it is Medicaid data or vital statistics, it takes time to collect and ensure accuracy. Now, we've shifted to real-time reporting for COVID-19, and we make constant updates to provide accurate and up-to-date information, she wrote. An analysis of new cases in 10 other large Iowa counties showed discrepancies exist elsewhere. In Linn County, for instance, the county's confirmed case total climbed by 85 over 3 days. However, the day-to-day tallies used to calculate positivity rates included just 71 cases. And in Polk County, underlying data showed 336 new positives over the same three-day span, but 324 were used in the state's positivity calculations. Much like the data discrepancies themselves, concerns over the reliability of state-issued COVID-19 data extend well beyond the northeast portion of Iowa. Phil Rader, Director of Communications and Public Affairs for Des Moines Public Schools, said via email that the district has had concerns about information and guidance from the state since the COVID-19 pandemic first started to impact Iowa. He also expressed concerns about the positivity thresholds established by the state. State officials said late last month that school leaders only can ask for permission to close buildings or districts if their counties have a 14-day average positivity rate of at least 15% and at least 10% of students are absent, or if the county has a 20% positivity rate over 14 days. We have seen no indication of what the state is basing this number on, and most public health experts suggest not returning into in-person classes if that figure is above the 3-5% range, Rader said. With these inflated thresholds, Rader said, officials believe that it will be extremely difficult, if not impossible, for the district to limit an outbreak. When Iowa's 15% positivity rate threshold is combined with the requirement to also have 10% absenteeism in school before they claim virtual learning can be considered, only one thing is certain. It will be too late to slow the spread of COVID-19 among our students, staff, and community, he wrote. In an interview with the TH last week, Iowa Public Health Director Caitlin Pedotti presented several more reasons why state positivity rates and underlying state-issued data failed to align. Pedotti said this vast difference is primarily the result of efforts to review and validate case information. She said the cumulative number shows the number of new cases in real time. But she claimed many new cases are missing key information, such as the date, the individual's name, or date of birth. According to Pedotti, new confirmed cases often are not added to a specific day or week until the necessary reviews are conducted by the IDPH. She went on to acknowledge that could lead to a time lag, resulting in fewer cases being calculated into the daily and 14-day positivity rates. One day later, Garrett told the TH that such discrepancies were common knowledge among Iowans. However, those on the front lines of statewide efforts to resume school beg to differ with that characterization. I can tell you that it was absolutely not common knowledge, said Jean Hesburgh, spokeswoman for the Iowa State Education Association. It was not common knowledge that positive cases were being backdated. It was not common knowledge what was discovered with the data flaw that was acknowledged by the state last week. And a number of other anomalies in the system were not common knowledge. The association, a union that represents teachers and other school employees across the state, recently filed suit against the state and the Iowa Department of Education in hopes of giving local school districts the autonomy to make their own reopening decisions rather than being bound by state oversight. Hesburgh said the union and many educators statewide remain concerned by the high thresholds established by the state, as well as the accuracy of the state-provided figures. By the state's own admission, they are not reliable numbers, she said. They have admitted that they have backdated positive cases, which has really messed up the positivity rates. I don't think those figures are reliable. Leading state officials on Thursday revealed another cause of ongoing data discrepancies. Reynolds said the state soon would begin counting a relatively new form of COVID-19 testing known as antigen testing. She went on to explain that these tests previously had been classified as inconclusive. Previous TH reporting unveiled that the state has been using inconclusive tests in the calculation of daily and 14-day positivity rates, a practice that artificially drove down these metrics. State officials shed further light on this erroneous practice Thursday, admitting that positive antigen tests were among those previously designated as inconclusive. State leaders indicated that the results of these positive antigen tests would be reflected in past and future positivity calculations, and Padotti acknowledged this would lead to a modest increase in positivity rates in several counties. Dr. Bobby Canero, the medical liaison for Dubuque County regarding COVID-19, explained that antigen tests provide a relatively new way to detect active coronavirus infections. He said such testing provides quicker results, similar in timing to pregnancy tests. Canero said he is concerned that positive antigen tests were incorrectly classified as inconclusive in previous calculations. Furthermore, he noted that the state's continued practice of tweaking data and revising its reporting methods has eroded confidence in such figures. The protocols continue to change in terms of how they are interpreting the data, he said. Until there is a reliable, consistent way of calculating the data, I will not be 100% confident in what I am seeing in the state's numbers. Our second piece from the front page begins with two pictures. We have a large dominating picture of a worker spraying something in the hallways of what appears to be a school. And it reads beneath the picture, Jeff Allen, head custodian at Prescott Elementary School, sprays disinfectant on the railings. And our second, smaller picture shows an employee wiping down desks. Prescott night custodian Dave Cummings disinfects a desk. And our article is indispensable. Dave Cummings finished wiping down a whiteboard with disinfectant at Prescott Elementary School this week, then turned to the last step in the cleaning process. He donned his safety glasses and walked through the classroom with a handheld disinfectant mister, spraying down the tops of desks and chairs to add one more layer of sanitation before students returned to school the next day. "It's like 2 minutes to a room and you're out," said Cummings, a night custodian at Prescott. "It's a nice way to do it and just another layer of disinfectant." Dubuque Community Schools custodial staff started out the new school year with a closer eye on cleaning practices in an effort to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. That includes extra rounds of disinfectant and a closer attention to cleaning high-touch areas, both while students are at school and after they leave for the day. I think it really made the custodial staff, not just in our buildings, but district-wide, indispensable, said Jeff Allen, head custodian at Prescott. We're doing our best to keep the students and staff as safe and healthy as we possibly can. The district's custodial staff this fall perform all of their usual cleaning duties, such as cleaning restrooms, desktops, and doorknobs, and vacuuming, plus additional and more frequent disinfecting. One of the last steps in the cleaning process now involves spraying surfaces with the district's new disinfectant misters, which adds a consistent layer of the hospital-grade product on top of custodians' other cleaning, said Bill Burkhart, the district's manager of buildings and grounds. It's allowed us to raise the level of sanitation in our buildings with no more help, Burkhart said. In the afternoons and evenings, Cummings cleans up the downstairs classrooms at Prescott, going through each room to take out the trash, vacuum, mop, and clean. He spends about 20 minutes on each room. There are fewer students at school each day because of the district's hybrid schedule, so that gives Cummings extra time to do a deep cleaning. He uses that time to focus on areas children are more likely to touch. We're trying to do a little more deep cleaning, he said. After a last round of misting classroom surfaces with a fine layer of disinfectant, custodians shut the door to the rooms, which remain closed until students return in the morning, Burkhart said. You've got two things working for you, disinfectant and time, he said. In addition to thoroughly cleaning rooms after students leave for the day, custodial staff also frequently clean surfaces during school hours. Allen goes through the school 3 to 4 times a day to mist disinfectant onto railings, door handles, and restroom stalls and other surfaces. He also works with teachers and paraprofessionals to help clean up after students eat lunch in their rooms. Other staff help with additional cleaning during the day. Each classroom is equipped with a bottle of disinfectant, and staff also wipe down students' spaces with food-grade sanitizer after breakfast and lunch. Prescott principal Vicki Sullivan said, I'm really pleased, she said. We understand what can help to reduce transmission. So that's a shared responsibility among all of us. Burkhart said most of the district's classrooms currently have their own bottles of disinfectant. Those that do not will have them soon. The district is using funds from the Federal Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act to pay for COVID-19-related custodial costs, district spokesman Mike Size said. The district has spent about $108,000 on those expenses so far. Cummings said he feels good about this year's cleaning procedures. I feel safe, and I hope everybody else does too, he said. And now we continue with our third and final front page piece. Election officials, voting by mail safe. Despite continuing changes in process due to COVID-19, area election officials in Iowa, Wisconsin, and Illinois foresee no threats to election security in 2020. Months after the COVID-19 pandemic impacted 2020 primary elections, the virus is still spreading. That means election officials are pressed to ensure processes keep the public as safe and the election as secure as they are able. As during the primaries, election officials in all three states expect mail-in absentee voting to play a huge role in the general election. We saw it in August and in April, said Colette Steffen, acting Platteville, Wisconsin city clerk. Already, we have a lot of requests in. Dubuque County Auditor Denise Dolan said that in previous years, the highest number of votes cast before Election Day has been about 21,000. This year, she is expecting between 30,000 and 33,000. That increase is by design, and all three states have encouraged mail-in voting as an alternative to in-person voting on Election Day. We sent out applications to voters who had voted in one of the last three elections automatically, said Joe Davies County Auditor Angela Kaiser. Then, anyone who registered between the last election and August 1st received one as well. She said her office had already seen signs of far greater interest in mail-in than ever before. That is definitely not something Joe Davies County has seen a lot of in the past, she said. But as mail-in voting is set to play a larger role than ever before, its security has been questioned. Locally, the three election officials said there's no threat to security by mail-in voting, no matter the state. There are checks and balances in the Iowa system, said Dolan. We've done absentee ballots long enough. To flood the system with absentee ballots in Iowa is impossible. It's bad information. To mail an absentee ballot in Iowa, auditors must have a signed request. When they receive a ballot envelope, they scan the code on the outside, which must match the code that was mailed to the voter's address. Another ballot cannot be cast. In Wisconsin, voters can request a ballot via the MyVoteWI website or via the local election office. It also allows them and officials to track the ballot envelope. Whether by that website or in hard copy, voters must also provide a match to the photo ID officials have on file. In Illinois, a voter's signature on the ballot must match the signature officials have on file. Kaiser said that a signature is then judged by a panel of three for each county. If two do not think it is the same signature, the ballot can be deemed invalid. Kaiser is dubious about the chances of fraud. The Vote by Mail initiative in response to the virus is just bringing to the forefront something we've been doing for years, she said. In each state, when the ballots arrive, they are held in secure, locked locations until just for or on election day. The time at which election officials can process absentee ballots varies by state. In Illinois, those panels can verify signatures anytime between 2 days after the envelope is received up until the day before Election Day. In Iowa, ballots can be removed from envelopes the day before Election Day. Dolan has bipartisan teams of two handle bundles of 50 at a time before they are stored again overnight. In Wisconsin, the envelopes can only be processed and then counted on Election Day. How late absentee ballots can be received also varies by state. According to Stefan, in Wisconsin, currently, ballots must be received by 8 p.m. on Election Day. This deadline was pushed back during the primaries by emergency order due to the pandemic, but no such order has yet been issued for November's election. In Iowa, the legislature passed a bill in 2019 to allow ballots postmarked before Election Day, but received after, to be counted, if received up to a week later. This stemmed from a controversy over the race for Iowa House District 55, in which Representative Michael Bergen, Republican from Dorchester, beat Democratic challenger Kayla Cather by just 9 votes. Following a recount in which 33 ballots that arrived after Election Day were not allowed to be counted. Illinois allows a 2-week window for ballots to arrive if postmarked by Election Day, according to Kaiser. There are some alternatives to mail-in voting. In all three states, in-person early voting hours have been extended. Then, Election Day voting will be always an option. In Wisconsin, voters also have drop boxes where voters can deposit their completed absentee ballots. Stefan said there is one already outside Platteville City Hall and that she is planning to set up 2 others around the city. In Iowa, auditors used those to great effect during the primaries when many courthouses were closed. Dolan said she even ordered 2 more, hoping to get some options further out in the county than the one permanently affixed to the courthouse door, which has been used for years. But the Iowa Secretary of State's office said recently that auditors have no such authority in state code. Clayton County Auditor Jennifer Garms said she hoped Iowa would reconsider the use of drop boxes. In a pandemic, people would rather not have contact, she said, and it's a good option for people who work during our hours or who have concerns about the Postal Service. Now let's turn to our opinion page, and we have our Friday Hour View quick takes. The editorials that reflect the consensus of the Telegraph Herald editorial board. And our first one, a frowny face, Iowa families need help recovering from derecho. More than 2 weeks after a devastating derecho swept through Iowa, many Iowans are struggling to put the pieces back together of their homes, their businesses, their lives. Governor Kim Reynolds has requested $4 billion in federal aid to help shore up the devastation that struck 27 counties, more than one-fourth of the state. The storm's fierce winds pounded across farmland and cities, with sustained winds as high as 140 miles an hour. The derecho left a path of debris in its wake, destroying homes and flattening 14 million acres of crops where fields had been lush with nature and mature corn and soybean plants. Tens of thousands of Iowans were without power for more than a week. Now people in the tri-state area and beyond are seeking ways to help, with many driving to the affected area, ready to roll up their sleeves. There is much to be done. To help put resources to best use, communities are asking people to reach out to coordinating organizations for direction, such as the United Way of East Central Iowa, UWECI.org, where donations will be accepted. For those who want to volunteer, visit UWECI.org/volunteer now, or go to the Volunteer Reception Center, 6301 Kirkwood Boulevard, Southwest Cedar Rapids, Iowa, or call 224-406-1366. The Hawkeye Area Community Action Plan, a nonprofit organization serving six of the impacted Iowa counties, is coordinating flood and disaster relief. To help, visit hacap.org. As always, the American Red Cross, redcross.org, is also helping organize disaster relief, as is the Salvation Army of the Heartland, centralusa.salvationarmy.org/heartland. Midwesterners help each other in times of need, and right now, our Heartland family needs our help. Our second quick take, smiley face. It was more than a decade ago now that St. Mary's Catholic Church ended its run as a worship space after more than 140 years of service to generations of parishioners. After that painful event, an organization called Friends of St. Mary's formed in hopes of doing something positive in response. It brought together civic leaders from the public and private sectors. And in time, the Steeple Square Initiative launched with the intention of preserving and developing the former church and its campus for community and neighborhood enhancement. Millions of dollars have been poured into the endeavor, including building restoration and renovation, and such program enhancements as an event space, housing, and childcare. Last week, locals gathered to honor a man who represented the spirit of St. Mary's and whose legacy lives on in the glory of the restored church steeple rising over downtown Dubuque. R. D. McDonald was a devoted parishioner and instilled that parish connection in his children. The McDonald family helped celebrate the christening of the R.D. McDonald steeple following the family's donation to help complete a $2.3 million renovation of the steeple. Dubuque owes a debt of gratitude to the McDonald family for their support in restoring this iconic edifice in the downtown skyline. May the R.D. McDonald steeple proudly watch over the community for decades to come. And our third piece, business organizations and government agencies have all have had to rethink ways of operating amid the pandemic and period of social distancing. Now, those entities are weighing which lessons learned in recent months could result in a new way of doing things. For the Dubuque County Sheriff's Department, the new way is actually the revival of an old way. Law enforcement officials plan to reinstate a house arrest program with ankle monitoring as an alternative to jail sentences for certain would-be inmates. The program was discontinued when the jail was expanded. But now, law enforcement and county officials are rethinking alternatives to incarceration. A house arrest program with monitoring equipment would reduce the jail population while saving the county money. The program also provides a better option for people with medical conditions and nonviolent offenders who could continue to maintain their employment. COVID-19 has changed our world in 2020, and most of the changes we'll be happy to see go away. But there are lessons to be learned in every circumstance, and a jail diversion alternative is a good outcome. And we now turn to two letters to the editor. The first one, Trump leadership, Republican in name only, from Susan Keyes, Kamala Court, Platteville. Diehard GOP conservatives support Trump. However, Trump, a registered Democrat from 2001 through 2009, hasn't demonstrated fiscal or moral conservatism. In 2002, Trump said the economy does better under the Democrats than the Republicans. And Jeb Bush pointed out that Trump contributed more money to Democrats than to Republicans. The U.S. budget deficit climbed to $2.81 million in the first 10 months of the budget year, exceeding any on record, writes Matt Ott of the Associated Press. The shortfall is expected to eventually reach levels for the fiscal year that ends September 30th, more than double the largest annual deficit on record. Trump purports to be pro-life, but he places children in cages, separating them from their parents at the border. How about the $2 million fine he paid for using his charity funds to boost his 2016 campaign? Take a long look at Trump's dictator style of leadership that promotes relatives and friends over knowledge and expertise. He is what he is, corrupt, undependable, and inconsistent, a Republican in name only. And he's not going to change over the next 4 years. Vote for the person, not the party. Vote Biden, Harris for level-headed, responsible, unifying leadership. And our second letter was Cardinal Hickory Creek Project Needed, from Dave Swanson, Stanton Road, Platteville. We live in a unique region of Wisconsin. The proposed transmission line crossing the Mississippi River is protected in protected areas, only heightens the disruption of natural scenic landscapes. This area contains the largest fish and wildlife habitat in the upper Mississippi River Basin. The Cardinal Hickory Creek Project is estimated to cost at least $500 million plus financing costs, with a mandated 10.2% rate of return for the developers. These costs would be borne by the ratepayers over the anticipated 30 to 40 year lifetime of the power line. As homeowners, we strive every day to use less energy and to use it efficiently. The reward for conserving energy is a penalty of long-term rate increases, of which we will receive no benefit. Should we need more power in the future, it would be more beneficial to use wind and solar power generated in our immediate area rather than shipping electricity from distant power plants. But that is not the case presently, as electrical usage is flat or declining because of the best practices by ratepayers. Who will benefit from building additional transmission lines? Certainly not the ratepayers who live in southwest Wisconsin. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. I'm Ken, and we've been reading from the Friday, August 28th, 2020 edition of our Telegraph Herald from Dubuque. I now turn to today's obituaries. Robert Pomerick, 83, of Dubuque, died Wednesday, August 26th, at his home in Assisi Village. In his own words, Bob was born December 29th, 1936, in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, the only child of George and Rose Washbush Pomerick. In Bob's senior year at St. Mary Springs High School, a letter arrived at school one day from legendary Loras basketball coach Vince Dowd, offering Bob a scholarship to play basketball at Loras. Bob had never heard of Loras College and was not exactly sure where Iowa was. Nevertheless, he traveled by Greyhound bus on a Sunday afternoon in September 1955 to Dubuque and the Loras campus, sight unseen, and enrolled. Everything he brought to Loras was contained in two suitcases, and one of them was not very large. During his senior year at Loras, Bob was interviewed by George Hansen of McGladrey, Hansen, Dunn, and Company. He accepted a position on the audit staff in the Chicago office of Arthur Anderson and Company. After receiving his BA degree in accounting from Loras, Bob enlisted in the Army in June 1959, spending 6 months active duty at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. In December 1959, he went to work in the Chicago office of Arthur Anderson and Company. In the fall of 1962, Bob began his 37-year teaching career by joining the accounting faculty at Loras College. He passed the Certified Public Accounting Exam in May 1963, receiving Iowa Certificate Number 640 from Virgil Hancher, who was the president of the University of Iowa and the speaker at the awards banquet. On August 22, 1964, Bob married Melita Hanton at St. Columbkill's Church in Dubuque. Bob received an MBA degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in August 1965. He was a pioneer in the development of computer usage at Loras, being the campus representative in a 1968-1970 project funded by the National Science Foundation, comprised of a regional computer center network headquartered at the University of Iowa under the direction of Gerald Wieg. Bob was a registration counselor for 17 successive years and served on numerous committees, including a memorable 3-year term as chair of the Arts and Lectures Series Committee, 1995 to 98. During the 1994-95 year, Bob and Melita enjoyed a sabbatical year when Bob had an appointment as a visiting scholar, admittedly a real stretch, at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. In 1991, Bob was honored to receive the Sears Roebuck Foundation Teaching Excellence and Campus Leadership Award. He was also very honored to receive a Loras Distinguished Alumnus Award in 2002. In 2016, Bob was inducted into the Loras College Athletic Hall of Fame as a contributor. Bob was rather well known for his dubious attempts at humor in the classroom. Frank Noonan coined the term Pomerisms in reference to some of the puns and stories. Physical fitness and exercise were a big part of Bob's life. He played on the basketball and tennis teams in high school and college. Tennis, in particular, was a lifelong love, as he spent many an hour over the years on the courts at Loras and elsewhere. For 11 years, Bob participated in USTA over 55 and over 65 singles tournaments at various sites in Iowa. Once retired, Bob liked to exercise every morning. In the colder months, he had a routine at the fitness center. From April into November or December, it was tennis or biking, which he resumed when he acquired a bicycle in 1992. Some additional interests which surfaced following retirement were crossword and Sudoku puzzles. Also, Bob enjoyed attending the Wednesday matinee performances during the live racing season at Dubuque Greyhound Park. Bob liked to attend events where food was served. After retirement in 1999, Bob was named a professor emeritus and he maintained his ties to the college. His colleagues, Karen Sturm and Deb Pauly, spearheaded an effort to establish the Robert Pomeranck Professorship in his honor. He occasionally helped out in the business department to fill in for a faculty member as needed. He was the official scorekeeper for Loras women's and men's basketball from 1998 through 2015. Bob also thoroughly enjoyed his work as an AARP tax aid volunteer for 17 years, beginning in 2001. He also served on the board of directors at the Dubuque Area Lifetime Center for over 6 years, part of that time being spent in the role of treasurer. Bob also took pleasure in his visits to Wrigley Field, benefiting from complimentary tickets from two former students. He and Melita greatly enjoyed the weekly duplicate bridge games at the Lifetime Center. They also attended many concerts and plays at Loras and other Dubuque venues and elsewhere. Travel to visit children and grandchildren was also a distinct pleasure. One of the highlights of Bob's life was being at Center Court at Wimbledon in 1998 for the finals of the men's singles. Pete Sampras beat Goran Ivanisevic in 5 sets. And the women's doubles. Bob loved competition and always did his best to win, whether it was in board games with his children or the tennis or racquetball court, at the bridge table, or in the fantasy football league with his Loras colleagues. He considered himself extremely fortunate to have survived cardiac arrest, suffered in November 2002, prostate cancer, diagnosed in November 2007, and a stroke suffered in April 2015. In his healthier years, he was a regular blood donor. In 2007, Bob was granted a free life membership in the American Accounting Association by virtue of having been a member of the AAA for 40 consecutive years. Memorials may be given to the Pomeranck Professorship at Loras College, the Dubuque Rescue Mission, or the charity of your choice. A private mass of Christian burial will be held at Church of the Nativity with Reverend Monsignor James Miller as the celebrant. Burial will be in Mount Olivet Cemetery in Key West. There will be a public memorial mass and celebration of life held at a later date. Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service is in the care of the arrangements, and condolences can be sent to the family by visiting Bob's obituary, www.hskfhcares.com. Marcella Johnson, Waukon. Marcella Johnson, 92, of Waukon, died on Tuesday, August 25th. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 29th, at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Waukon. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. today at the church, where there will be a 3:30 scripture service, and 1 hour before the service Saturday. Burial will be in Mount Olivet Cemetery in Waukon. Martin Grau Funeral Home in Waukon is assisting the family. Edwin Wagner. Edwin Ed Wagner, age 96, of Dubuque, passed away unexpectedly at 4:54 p.m. on Saturday, August 22nd at Mercy One, Dubuque, surrounded by his loving family. To celebrate Ed's life, family and friends may visit from 3 until 5 p.m. Monday, August 31st at Bear Funeral Home. Due to the COVID-19 mandate issued by the city of Dubuque, all who attend will be required to wear a face covering. To honor Ed's life, funeral services will be held immediately following visitation at 5 p.m. on Monday, August 31st at Bear Funeral Home, with Deacon Bill Busson officiating. Burial will be in Linwood Cemetery. Ed was born May 26, 1924, in Dubuque, son of Edwin A. and Marie Schuler Wagner. Ed graduated from Dubuque Senior High School, class of 1942. After school, Ed joined the U.S. Army Transportation Corps. Upon completion of his military service, Ed trained in repairing office equipment in Chicago and Springfield, Missouri. While in Springfield, he would discover a little restaurant with a beautiful waitress working there that would turn out to be his soulmate. Ed married the love of his life, Billie Jean Simmons, June 5th, 1948, in Springfield, Missouri. The two moved to Dubuque, where they raised their son and celebrated 62 years of marriage together before Jean passed away March 29, 2011. He was always a hard worker who was employed with Business Supply Company for several years before going into retail at the Milk House on University. He would return to Business Supply for a short time before going to work with Apple River Chemical Company, where he would retire at age 65. Whether he found himself with some free time on his hands, or when he did, Ed enjoyed fixing things around the house, much to Jean's delight. He was very mechanical and well known for traveling to relatives' homes and helping them with projects as well. In his younger days, Ed enjoyed squirrel hunting, which it turned out was actually more like squirrel watching. He was an avid fisherman, and Massey Station was by far his favorite fishing hole. We are saddened at losing Ed in our daily lives, but take some comfort in knowing that he is now reunited with his beloved Jean. Memorials will be accepted by the family and may be mailed to Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, Dubuque, 52001. Attention, Edwin Wagner family. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.bearfuneralhome.com. Lloyd J. Jasper, Dyersville. Lloyd J. Jasper, 79, of Dyersville, passed away Wednesday, August 26th at Mercy One Medical Center in Dubuque. Visitation will be held from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday, August 29th at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville, where a massive Christian burial will commence at 10:30 a.m. Reverend Anthony Nikitia will officiate and Deacon Dan Hager will assist. Burial will be at St. Francis Cemetery, where American Legion Post 137 will accord military honors. Lloyd was born December 1, 1940, in Dyersville, the son of Emil and Monica Jasper. He married Carol Menson on September 7, 1964, in Dyersville. Together, they raised their family and farmed near Dyersville and co-owned and managed All Star Feeds until retirement. Lloyd worked many years on his custom toys and was very proud of his craft. He was featured in the Toy Farmer magazine 4 times. He was a very social person and enjoyed being with his children and their families, including regular annual vacations together. He also spent many hours playing cards with friends. He was a loving husband, father, and grandfather. In lieu of flowers, memorials are preferred to St. Francis Xavier Basilica. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.kramerfuneralhome.com. Elaine M. Thumzer. Mrs. Frank W. Elaine M. Thumzer, 86, of Dubuque, passed away August 27th at Hawkeye Care Center. Graveside services will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, August 29th at Dubuque Memorial Gardens, 8289 Jekyll Lane, Dubuque, Iowa, 52003. According to Elaine's wishes, no public visitation will be held. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory is assisting the family. Elaine was born June 23, 1934, in Bellevue, the daughter of Glenn and Elsie Rowe Heckles Miller. She married Frank Thumzer September 22, 1978. Mrs. Thumzer was employed for many years at United Telephone, the Telegraph Herald, and Flex Steel Industries. Frank and Elaine enjoyed many years of traveling around the USA. They especially enjoyed golfing together and dancing every week. They enjoyed Tuesday evenings at the Morocco with friends. William Demkier. William Bill Demkier, 70, of Dubuque, left on his eternal fishing trip on Tuesday, August 25th, as a result of heart complications. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. until noon on Monday, August 31st, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home. A funeral service will follow the visitation at the funeral home beginning at noon. Please come dressed as Bill would expect to see you on any given day. The service will be live streamed on Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home's Facebook page and will also be available to view later at www.hskfhcares.com. Due to the current Dubuque City Ordinance, masks are required in the funeral home. Please respect our current social distancing requirements. If you're not feeling well or unable to attend, we encourage you to visit us online or to send a message to Bill's family. Bill was born January 16th, 1950 in Dubuque, the son of Harold and Dorothy Schneider Demkier. On August 9th, 1969, he married the love of his life, Sandra Sam Seller, in Bellevue. They literally have been in each other's pocket since they were teenagers, and their love for one another was like no other. Bill's passion for hunting and fishing and Sam's passion for fishing led to them owning and operating Signet Lake Camp in Menaki, Ontario, Canada, for over 25 years. Upon retirement, they built a cabin on the lake and continued spending summers there, as their heart was always in Canada. Bill most enjoyed times spent with friends and family, doing what he enjoyed most. This led to many lifelong and new friendships over the years. While Bill loved all of his family equally and treasured each and every one of them, one of his most talked about memories of Canada was when his two nieces, Chelsea and Courtney, who were 4 and 7 at the time, spent the summer with them learning how to fish. Bill's famous saying for years after was, "I wished there was a pill I could give those girls to keep them little." Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral and Cremation Services is in care of the arrangements. A photo tribute can be viewed and condolences can be sent to the family by visiting Bill's obituary, www.hskfhcares.com. Donald Curley. Donald Buckshot Curley, 85, of Galena, died Wednesday, August 26th at his home. A gathering will be held from 11 a.m. to noon Saturday, September 5th, at St. Michael's Catholic Cemetery in Galena. A private family service will be held prior to the gathering. Furlong Funeral Chapel of Galena is assisting the family. Well, with all of these passings, many people saddened by them, but some really amazing people, we do have the little ones who have arrived, and here we have the births in today's paper. On Tuesday, August 25th, Williams Davidson, Breshawn Williams, and Yvette Davison of Dubuque, a boy at Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital in Dubuque. And on Wednesday, August 26th, Timmerman, Michael and Caitlin Timmerman of Cuba City, a boy at Southwest Health in Platteville, and Laundry, Casey and Jordan Laundrie of Dubuque, a girl at Southwest Health. Welcome aboard, all you little ones. We had a lot of our front page pieces today, so we don't have a lot of time left. Let me touch upon a couple of news and brief pieces from our area. Former Dubuque Bank vice president sentenced to probation on federal charges. A former vice president of Dubuque Bank was sentenced Thursday to probation for lying about a loan in a move that cost the institution more than $320,000. Dan Radins, 66, of Dubuque, was sentenced in U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids to 3 years probation in order to pay about $324,000 in restitution. He previously pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy to make a false statement. Court documents state that the conspiracy occurred from 2007 to 2009, when Radis served as vice president and lending officer for Fidelity Bank and Trust. During that time, he conspired with another person to lie to the bank about how money the bank was loaning to the other person was being used. Specifically, they lied about using the money to complete a particular construction project when instead it was being used elsewhere. The other person referenced in the court documents was not named. Dubuque Holy Family Schools is releasing early today, as are the other Dubuque public schools. West Delaware and Edgewood-Colesburg school districts are among the other local districts that will have an early release. 5 local organizations receive Iowa grants to help store food donations. 5 local organizations have received state grants to increase storage of donated food items. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources awarded a $204,034 award in food storage capacity grants to organizations throughout the state, according to a press release. It states that the grants allow for the purchase of Energy Star refrigerators and freezers and shelving for items for distribution. The local ones in Bellevue: Breadbasket, $1,100 for an upright freezer. Dubuque Faith Temple United Pentecostal, $8,471 for walk-in freezer. Dubuque Food Pantry, $10,000 walk-in cooler. Dubuque St. Vincent's de Paul, $5,000 refrigerator merchandisers. And Epworth St. Patrick Parish, $1,495 and some cents for a refrigerator. And that really brings us to the end of today's reading, today being August 28th. Today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, brought to you by, as always, IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, helped in part by the DuPaco R.W. Hafer Foundation. And again, it has been Ken doing the reading, a joy that I have every week, and I'm glad to have been with you today. Have a safe weekend ahead. It might cool off a little bit, but nonetheless, be safe out there and enjoy what can be enjoyed. There's always something good in life. Go find it. Until next week, so long.